Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people, some well-known and others not as much, navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them a curve. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, the bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve. These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and flourish. I hope you enjoy The Bend and add it to your subscriptions. And if you need help with your own personal navigation and are in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone, 2 Manage Vets Consulting. Now enjoy The Bend and be inspired by our amazing guest. Welcome.
All right, we are recording. So welcome to The Bend. Today I have a very special guest. I like to think about Josh, who's like, maybe he's my younger sibling in psychological thought. How about that? Because we really do believe a lot of things about building culture in hospitals and how you treat your people as managers. He believes that all veterinary professionals deserve to feel fulfilled by their work each and every day. Amen, Josh. And through his company, Flourish Veterinary Consulting, he combines more than 20 years of veterinary experience, a master's in applied positive psychology and coaching psychology, and education in positive leadership and positive organizational scholarship to empower veterinary organizations in cultivating environments where veterinary professionals live. And Josh's last name, I just wanted to clarify this for everybody, is Weissman.
Weissman, yes, Weissman. Well done, well done.
That's right. So Josh, thanks so much for joining me today. I know you have a busy schedule. We're all doing a little different than our usual travel. So we were doing a lot of virtual work from home. And I know that you did start out your profession in the veterinary space. So when you were a kid, what was your original thoughts? What did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, so actually, this is actually kind of ironic. My mother moved recently, and so she found like a pile of, you know, random tidbits from all of our childhoods, and she put them together in little boxes and gave them to us. And one of the things in there, I want to say it was in kindergarten. So I lived in Milwaukee at the time, and one of the local newspapers, they sent a reporter to our school to interview all the kindergartners to ask us, what do you want to be when you grow up? And somehow, like, my picture was part of this like story that was in the newspaper, and it, you know, it listed all the kids in the class and what their response was. And believe it or not, my response was, I wanted to be like a professional singer, which is hilarious because if I start singing right now, I guarantee you that your subscriptions to this podcast will plummet. But yeah, apparently as a little kid, that was my dream.
A professional singer. You know, it's really funny how our perspective changes as we grow up, and then reality might set in. Because, and of course, for me, my name is now Debbie Boone, and I got married in the 70s. So Debbie Boone's "You Light Up My Life" was the number one song the year I got married. And so one of my social media challenges is to not get muddied with the Debbie Boone who sings "You Light Up My Life" and instead be Debbie Boone, veterinary CBPM, whatever.
Right.
We're out there. Yeah.
It's a great song, by the way.
Yeah, well, yeah. I had it played at my wedding. I mean, it was too good to pass up, right?
Of course.
My husband said he married me and made me famous. Thank you very much for that. So when you were growing up, since you obviously did not become the rock star that you dreamed of, what path did you follow? Because you have some interesting, and I got to tell you, I'm so envious of your education, because I think, I should have done that. I really wish I should have done that. So what was the path that got you there?
Yeah, so in high school, I was one of those kind of grungy kids with hair down to the bottom of my back, and I played guitar, and we had a heavy metal band, and I had this vision that, you know, rather than be the singer, I was going to be a guitarist in a, you know, some sort of famous heavy metal band. And so I ended up applying to Berklee College of Music, and I got like a probationary acceptance. I had to go for a summer semester right after I graduated high school to sort of like prove that I could hack it. And then if I got decent grades, then I would get accepted. And so I went out to Boston and I was at Berklee College of Music for a summer semester. And I'll be honest with you, I hated it. I actually really totally hated it. I loved being in the Back Bay of Boston. It was such a great area. And I met some pretty neat kids out there, but I don't know. It's just so, it's so cutthroat. And, you know, everybody wants to, I've never in my life had such a struggle, like really making good relational connections, because everybody was so much more interested in where you were at with your instrument than who you are as a person, or at least that's how it felt to me. And it really just kind of hammered home for me that this really is not a career path that I want to take. So I went back to Wisconsin, where I was living at the time. And I said, well, gosh, now what am I going to do? So I just went to a community college locally while I tried to figure out kind of my next steps. And ended up signing up for a philosophy class, an introduction to philosophy of all things. And the professor, Dr. Putman, such an amazing guy. That was just one of the best experiences I'd ever had in my entire educational path. And so I fell in love with the field and took all of the philosophy courses I could. When I moved out to Colorado and I started at the University of Colorado, that's what I declared as my major. I was going to get a philosophy degree. I had these grand visions of I was going to be the next chapter in the Philosophy 101 books, which, you know, I mean, it's pretty bombastic and self-aggrandizing, but that's, you know, when you're a philosopher.
Hey, somebody's got to do it, right? Might as well be you. Yeah.
So started taking all these philosophy courses and I loved them. I loved just the, you know, the sitting in a room with really, really intelligent people and challenging each other in productive ways and having these, you know, deep, thoughtful conversations and really sort of mentally exploring the universe, if you will. It just filled my cup. And I also, you know, in fairly short order, recognized that my options were be a professor or find another career. And so neither of those really seemed appealing to me through philosophy. And so I started looking at other things. My father is a doctor. So I grew up around medicine. We've always had animals, you know, the age old story, right? So I started working at a veterinary hospital and thought maybe I'd go to vet school someday. So I finished the philosophy degree, but I took all of the, like, you know, biology and chemistry and all that stuff with some plans of going to vet school, which sort of quickly fell off the radar as I learned more and more about veterinary school and being a veterinarian. I don't really want to do that, but I do love working in this field. So I just kept at it and eventually sort of stumbled into hospital ownership and management. I mean, literally, like one day I'm working as a tech. So you have to picture this. I'm a technician. I've just gotten a raise to get me up to $10 an hour, right? And I've been working at this hospital for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, something like that. And there was a doctor there who her husband owned another hospital in the area. And I had actually worked for him a few years prior. She comes to work one day, just like gleaming, super, super excited. Hey, you know, we sold our practice. We're going to retire. We're going to travel the world. Who bought it? Oh, you know, two of the associates and one of our technicians. And I went, wait a second.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a veterinarian to own a veterinary hospital?
Yeah.
That's cool. Got on a Google, confirmed that it was true. Literally walked into the doctor's office, sat down next to one of my favorite docs and said, hey, you want to buy a vet hospital with me? And she was like, sure. And 6 months later, we bought a vet hospital.
Oh my gosh.
That was it.
A little serendipity. You know,
yeah.
Happy accidents happen to us all the time. And I'm like you. That was kind of my path too. Because I always wanted to be a veterinarian starting at like age of five. This was tunnel vision. This is what I was going to do. And when I applied to only one college, my mom was freaking out. She's, what if you don't get in? I went, I'm getting in. And it's a good thing I did, because I applied to NC State under, so I have a pre-vet animal science degree. But like you, after 4 years, I went, I don't want to go to school. I don't want to be a veterinarian anymore.
More school. Yeah.
More school. But I did just love the profession and started as a part-time receptionist, foot in the door kind of thing, and then, you know, here you go. But sometimes it's just the people who come into your life and these little serendipitous moments that it's the time to take the chance, right? It's the time to make the leap. And this is what I wanted to talk to you a lot today about, because so many people are afraid to take the chance.
Sure.
And you and I talk about fear and change and the all the challenges that brings. So tell me when you stepped into that office and said, hey, let's go buy a veterinary hospital. Tell me your mindset. Were you afraid, or did you just do it and not even think about it yet until the, and maybe later the fear came?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I got to be honest with you, thinking back on it now, I don't think I really was that afraid. And I'm, you know, if I'm being perfectly honest, there was probably a little bit of ego to it. You know, the hospital that I was working at, it was a well-known, relatively successful practice. It had been around for decades. And I looked at how the leadership handled things there, how it worked. You know, we had essentially a single owner who was in the practice 10 or 12 hours a week, which in and of itself, I don't think is a bad problem or bad thing, so long as there is strong leadership in place. But there wasn't. She had, she had a woman who was in a leadership position, but was really kind of a glorified, you know, administrative assistant. She didn't really have any true autonomy, no real authority. It was very clicky there. And I looked at things and I said, well, gosh, you know, if this practice can do so well with this absence of real leadership, I can do at least that, you know?
Yeah.
And so I really do believe that there was a little bit of ego there, but I think that, you know, just going into that thought process, for me, it was just kind of like, you know, what's the worst thing that could happen here? Mm-hmm. I could totally fail. And then, you know, there's an asset to sell, or, you know, the worst thing that could happen is we fall flat on our face. We go out of business. I have to declare bankruptcy and I'm still a technician making $10 an hour.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so I don't know, I guess maybe it was the dream of the opportunity so far outweighed the fear of the risk that it just made it worth taking the leap.
Yeah, I think that's true for a lot of people who do that, who take the risk.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times so many people who have opportunities maybe come by, first of all, that maybe they don't recognize the opportunity, or they don't think they have the skill set to take advantage of the opportunity. And I think this is true for women more than men, because men will go, hey, screw it, I'm going for it, right?
Sure.
And women will go, well, I don't have quite all the boxes checked that is required for 100% of this opportunity, so maybe I won't do that.
Yeah.
And I think that we have got to, we have a major problem with perfectionism in veterinary medicine.
Agreed.
And sometimes good is good enough to take the chance, to do the thing.
Yep.
And then you'll figure it out as you go. But we want everything to be so perfect before we make a move that sometimes the moment passes and we lose opportunity. So if you were and I were coaching someone, we would coach them to say, what's the worst thing that can happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
You and I both talked about the story we tell ourselves. And this is a huge part of the story we tell ourselves is I'm not enough, I can't do it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, everybody started from that position of not knowing everything they know. And you and I have both grown consulting practices from ground zero.
Yeah.
And when you, that first day, you go and go, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm going to do something. And I've got some knowledge here and I'm going to put it out there for people. And maybe they'll think that's worthwhile. So let's do that.
Yeah.
So I do know that let's talk a little bit about this, building this hospital and what happened, your curve in the road.
Sure. So we bought this practice and it ended up being myself and two veterinarians. And we ended up buying the hospital. It was a practice that had existed for about 25 years. But the owner was kind of struggling to keep associates. And that was his sort of, you know, succession plan was to hire an associate, train them up, sell the practice to them, but he couldn't really keep associates in the practice. So we ended up selling it publicly. So when we bought it, it was essentially a one doctor hospital and it had three consecutive years of declining revenue. Now part of that was because he had two associates, you know, for a full year, 3 years prior, lost the associate about a third of the way through that second year. And then the third year was just him the whole year. So we come in with two doctors trying to take a one doctor hospital and build it up to two doctors as quickly as possible. And it was a bit of a rough road. All of us took substantial pay cuts. We didn't really pay ourselves for the first couple, 3 months. There were challenges that came along with that, just like any entrepreneurial endeavor. But over time, it built up. And, you know, within 3 years, we were not just turning a profit, but hiring associates, you know, increasing the size of the staff. And when I left, after about 5 years, we'd actually reached triple revenue from when we bought the hospital. So the fair market value, the valuation came in at just over double, about two and a quarter times what we paid for it when I left and sold my equity. So it was a success from every sort of external metric that you would have. And it's something that I'm incredibly proud of. But I look back on it now and I realize that while it was a success, it wasn't all the success that it could have been. I think that a lot of the decisions that I made as a partner and as a leader and as a human being were not the very best. And, you know, I got very much caught up in chasing sort of your standard objective public definition of success and started to really lose sight of my own personal values and, you know, how I believe in being as a human being and as a leader, as a positive leader. And that sort of took me down a path that ended up resulting in kind of a big crash and burn, which I think is kind of what you're getting at with that curve in the road. So
that curve in the road.
So, you know, we had a lot of success there, and I, for me, it was a realization that, you know, I was kind of a validation. I was right. I can do this at least as good as others. And in some ways, maybe even better. And man, if I can do it at one, why not do it at two or three or four? So that's what I started to explore was opportunities to get into multi-hospital ownership. And I got really interested in public speaking, consulting work, so on and so forth. And I'd made some great connections in the field. And one of them who became a friend, came to me with this opportunity to buy into a hospital in Cheyenne, which is about 75 miles north of where I live. And so I jumped at the opportunity. And I wanted to bring my partners in from the other practice, but they were just not interested. They very much were content with this is, you know, where the hospital was, the workload that they had, the amount of money that they were making, all of that stuff. They didn't want to rock the boat at all. And so we agreed to amicably part ways. That's when I sold my equity there. And then I moved on to this other opportunity. And it was a lot of negotiation. And finally, we got introduced to, through another mutual colleague in the field, got introduced to the Startup Consolidating Group. And we all met and started talking about this practice in Cheyenne. And these guys had been looking at the field for the last 2 or 3 years and finally decided that they wanted to create this consolidator and start buying hospitals. And their model was to partner with on-site owners. And so since I was local, and my friend, you know, was also involved in this, it made sense. We all got together and bought the hospital as a partnership. And then I started commuting to this practice 75 miles from my house. Now this hospital, objectively on paper, was an incredible opportunity, vastly underperforming, had existed, you know, in the community for over 30 years. So it had a reputation, some of which was good, some of which was bad, but it was unknown.
Very known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, was just ripe for better leadership. And so I had this idea, this vision that I was going to, you know, kind of sweep in and turn the culture around and build up this practice into an incredible success. And in some ways it was the first full 12 months that we were there was the highest gross revenue in the hospital's history. So, you know, so we did make a difference on the business side of things, but there, again, there were a lot of decisions that I made, a lot of approaches that I took, a lot of things that I said yes to when my gut said say no or vice versa, that I look back on now and I would have done differently. And all of that combined, those bad decisions, commuting 2.5 to 3 hours a day, doing not a great job of turning this you know, negative culture around in the practice, not being on the same page with the prior owner who we retained as a full-time employee, having a little bit different perspective and approach from my partners, and then just working way, way, way too much, way too much. So running this hospital 7 days a week, trying to do some consulting work as well, trying to help the consolidating group identify new acquisition opportunities, help them with due diligence, flying out to some of these practices, doing some training. The joke I tell is of the 168 hours in any given week, I worked about 200. I mean, it was just, it was insane. It was not at all sustainable. And so even though I was making all of this money, like I, at this point in time, I'm making more money than I've ever made before. I have unbelievable opportunities in front of me. And internally, I was just completely struggling. But I thought that's what you're supposed to do. Gosh, Debbie, it's, you know, this is America, right?
It's America, that's right. Let's
you work your ass
ourselves
off
and burn that candle at both ends. And,
exactly.
Until we just keel over dead with a heart attack. That's
exactly
what we do.
So I thought, you know, stop your bitching, stop complaining, look at what you have. People would be jealous. Put your big boy pants on, you know, your big boy pants, and just keep going forward. So that's what I did until I couldn't anymore. Mm-hmm. And I had this like epic burnout. Like, I mean, it's amazing for me to like think back to this experience. So it's a March morning and I'm in the kitchen and I'm scrambling eggs for breakfast for my wife and I, and I suddenly just stop and burst out in uncontrollable tears. And like, I couldn't stop it. And it wasn't like something specific happened. It was just like the thought of getting in my car and driving that 75 miles one more time was so unbelievably unbearable that I just didn't know how to cope. And so, yeah, that was kind of my rock bottom.
Yeah. So I think it's so telling that you said I had all the trappings of success. But emotionally and just mentally, it wasn't there, you know? Yeah. So it's, I mean, we always know that money doesn't buy happiness, but it can also buy a lot of misery. And so I think that one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about was boundaries, because apparently your boundaries didn't exist at this point, and you
not
had just said yes to everything. And I think that sometimes as an entrepreneur, and I know that I've been guilty of that too, that you are, especially as a consultant, because you don't know where your next paycheck is coming from. Mm-hmm. It's completely driven by you and your ability to rainmake.
Yeah.
So do you say yes to everything? And do you just keep driving yourself to the point where, well, yeah, I could do one more thing, or yeah, I could do one more thing. 15 years into it, I will tell you that you cannot.
Right.
and at some point you have to say, you know, I'd love to do that for you, but I can't do it for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And are you willing to wait for that?
Yeah.
And some people are yes, and some people, well, I can't wait that long. Well, here's another person. I'll refer you over to somebody else because then maybe they have the bandwidth, but I don't. And because it's simultaneously, you have to live your life.
Yeah.
And for many, many years, I have taught people, you only get one shot at this.
Yeah.
You better enjoy it, you know? So life has to be lived and work has to be done, and they should integrate well together so that you enjoy both of them.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So what happened next? You know?
Yeah. So what happened next was it took a lot of cajoling and support from people who care about me, because even then in that moment, I wasn't going to stop. I just didn't think I could. I couldn't give myself permission to do so. But, you know, I have a very loving wife who's incredibly supportive and cares a lot more about me than dollars. You know, I found myself a really good coach, which made a huge, huge difference in that point in my life. And they helped me give myself permission to not have to be that way. Which was huge. You know, I ultimately, what it boils down to for me, Debbie, is that I had built up a habit of creating a lifestyle that was meant to meet the obligations of other human beings. So everything that I did, every decision I made, every thought that I have, every behavior, every action was put through the prism of what do my partners seem to want and need? What does the business seem to want and need? You know, what do the people around me seem to want and need? And whatever I need, it didn't even come last. It just didn't enter the equation. And that's not an okay way to be. If you're living your life entirely for other people, you're not going to succeed at living your life well. You can't thrive under those circumstances. And so it took me a little while. It took me a few months to kind of wrap my head around that. And in that, you know, I realized that a lot of the way that we do things in vet med, that's, you know, it contributes to us building those kinds of habits. And those habits are not energizing. They are depleting. Over time, our performance and our well-being will suffer. Now, I'm not saying that we can't be givers. We need to be healthy givers. I don't know if you're familiar with the work that Adam Grant has done, his book, Give and Take. But he's done some pretty rigorous research actually on this concept and this idea that there are sort of different types of people. There are givers, takers, and matchers essentially. And takers are blatantly obvious. Like we know when we see a taker. A really good example of a taker is somebody who kisses up and kicks down, right? You know, they're truly just out for themselves. And they will take whatever they can. Interestingly, across his pretty, pretty robust and very extensive research, he finds that they're not as common as we tend to think. You know, true takers may be only like 10% of the people that we encounter in the world, which means that
they have a little some sociopathic tendencies too, because they are very self-centered and self-seeking. Yeah.
The bulk of people are what we call matchers. And so these are the people who they're going to, you know, the energy that they give off is in response, direct response to the energy that they get. So when you have a bunch of matchers in a team, in an organization, in a community with a taker, they will turn into takers. You remove the taker and replace it with a giver, and they will all turn into givers. Now, givers are generally good. And in the long term, we find conclusively they succeed more on average, more consistently than takers do. Givers succeed better if they are healthy givers, meaning that they are givers with boundaries. And what I had become was a giver of obligation. And so I couldn't have any boundaries. And I think that a lot of the way that we do things in vet med, the way that we lead our organizations, the cultures that we develop, the expectations we have for ourselves, the hidden curriculum in our schools, it all contributes to us becoming givers without boundaries. And that's not healthy. So I decided at that time that my new mission, because of my personal experience and what I started to really have this vivid view of in our community, my mission was going to become finding a better way. Finding a way to help us embrace an approach to leadership, an approach to culture, an approach to relationships and how we do things that enables people to be healthy givers in veterinary medicine. Because we are called to this work for a reason. We want to give of ourselves to the world. We want to feel like we're contributing in meaningful ways. So we need to have an environment that allows us to do that in a healthy way. So I decided to leave everything and I was on a mission. I was going to discover this better way for the whole community. So I sold my equity. I resigned my position as hospital director, trained up a replacement. I left the consulting firm that I was involved in and I left the consolidating group and I went back to school. And I just started like absorbing knowledge and information. And I really wanted it to be from an evidence-based background. I didn't want to, you know, just read, hoity-toity feel-good things. I wanted it to come from some sort of a scientific background. So that's how I got attracted to positive psychology, because that's what it is. It's a rigorous scientific, a field of study. And that sort of led me into discovering positive organizational scholarship, which is the same kind of thing. Positive leadership, the science of positive leadership, organizational and industrial psychology, all these kinds of things that take a rigorous research approach. They're basically sort of the collective umbrella of the science of human thriving under the auspices of work and acquiring this knowledge so that I can bring that to the field of veterinary medicine in really digestible and applicable ways. So that's what I do now. That's where Flourish came from. So I launched this company to take all of that knowledge that's coming out of science and bring it to our community so that folks like you and, you know, the managers that I talk to and the hospital directors and medical directors and hospital owners and technicians and CSRs and everybody can play some sort of a role in cultivating the environment that allows us to be the healthy givers we deserve to be.
I love that. I do love that. I agree with you so much. So much of my, I guess, expertise comes from just having grown up in a different business environment. My parents owning restaurants, very much hospitality, customer service, but also an environment where my parents believed if you looked after your people looked after your business.
Yes.
And it's the only way I knew how to do it. So when I went into work in veterinary medicine, I brought that with me, the hospitality for the client service part of it, but also that protection of my team. And it astounds me still that people go, I don't have time in the day to go to the bathroom. And I went, my staff had an hour for lunch. It was blocked out. It was scheduled. It was controlled. And you went to lunch.
Right.
And at night, we locked the door and we went home. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of my doctors would come back and check on a hospitalized case every now and then. But honestly, we went home. And so when I got out and I started consulting, I was almost astonished at the typical veterinary hospital that said, oh, God, you know, where's your writing records 2 hours after we close? And we never get to go to lunch, and we never get to go to the bathroom, and our clients are calling us all hours of the day and night. And I went, this is all stuff that you've created. And, you know, this is a runaway horse, and we control the reins, but we don't think we do.
Yeah.
And I think there's such a scarcity mentality a lot of times.
Yeah.
In veterinary practice, that I've got to take it all, I've got to do it all. I can't make anybody mad. I can't not have every one of those clients, even if they're not my ideal customer, right? So I'm taking them all. And all that does is just exactly what you experience. You just wake up one day and you're completely fried because you can't do all that. You know, you only have so much bandwidth, so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And if your brain is in a constant state of agitation, you can't even think how to get yourself out of it.
Right, exactly.
That's the other thing, too. I think I told you I was driving home last night from a trip, and it was 4 hours in a blinding rainstorm. But I was binge listening to Brené Brown's podcast. And she had an author on there who had written a book called Stretch. And I don't know if you've read it. I haven't read it, but I will read it. I will read it now. But it talked about stretching and chasing. So stretching allows us to, take a break and mentally figure out where our next step is or what creative thing that we can do to improve. And chasing is what we were talking about when we first started our businesses. It's constantly looking and here's the next thing I have to do and here's the next thing I have to buy and here's the way I have to look and here's the way I have to act and here's the stuff I have to, house I have to live in and all these trappings of supposed success that are based on what other people have told us matters rather than what really matters to us.
Yep.
So, you know, these are sometimes lessons learned. I mean, I'm old. I just learned stuff. So, and you have wonderful education that and life experience that showed us that stuff. So the goal of this whole podcast is that we share that stuff with other people so they don't have to screw up like we did.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Just learn this stuff from us. So when you made that change and you decided to, you know, go back to school and how did you what were your thought processes there? And did you say, okay, this is I've got to gather information before I can really start moving forward with what I want to do next?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, probably the biggest thing that was made an impact on me was the support system I had around me. I think that, you know, we consistently see, it's interesting now to look back on it, having gotten the education. When we look at research in resiliency, you know, we consistently see over and over and over again across thousands of studies on, you know, resiliency in human beings, that the most resilient people are never resilient alone. You know, you don't bounce back from adversity all by yourself. We have this like vision of, you know, sort of like the superhero leader, yes. You know, this big, strong person, yes. Who can handle anything. But even that, like, look at, you know, I love to talk about the Avengers, right? Like, yeah. Look at the Avengers movie. And I know it's like, you know, it's made up and whatever, but I think it's a great analogy for this. You know, the Avengers, with all of their individual superpowers and might and strength, in the face of their greatest adversity, Thanos, could not win by themselves. They had to find a way to all come together and support and boost each other to have this great victory in, you know, Avengers Endgame. And that's exactly what we see in human beings. So there's absolutely no way that I would have even been able to approach this curve in the road, this bend, in a healthy and productive way, if I hadn't had the wherewithal to reach out to the people that care about me and share these things with them, take in their perspective, garner their support, actually ask for it, you know? So I think that was probably the biggest thing for me. And one of the major things for me, you know, I'll admit, I like to think of myself as a pretty progressive, you know, well-educated, somewhat Renaissance thinking, you know, kind of guy, but I'm also a white middle-class male who grew up in America. Like, you know, there are some implicit biases that I am constantly battling. One of which is that I'm the man in the house and, you know, I should be bringing in the dough and doing all these kinds of things. And so to even envision giving up that stuff, like I felt like I had to get permission from my wife, you know, which was the easiest thing in the world to do.
Yeah.
Because all that she cared about was my well-being. She's, you know, I mean, she literally said to me at one point, I don't care if you don't make a single dollar. This is not sustainable for you. You have to make a change, you know? So you know, but I wouldn't have even had that permission if I hadn't sought it from her. So, you know, having that connection and using that connection was really vital for me. And then starting to get comfortable with discomfort, you know, and the discomfort of a little bit of uncertainty, not really knowing what my next steps were going to be, and recognizing that I'm not going to be able to see through, you know, the clouds if I can't give myself the opportunity for the clouds to clear. And so that's why I made, you know, I could have made the decision of going to my partners and being like, something needs to change. How can we find a middle ground? But it really became obvious to me that I literally could not see the other side of the storm unless I left the storm. So that's what I decided to do, and give myself that space of like, okay, let's take a little bit of time and, you know, reevaluate and take some freedom to kind of explore a few different things and see what the next steps might be. I'll tell you something that was really awesome, totally unexpected, not something I even considered, but when it happened, so unbelievably validating. So I sat down with my partners, I told them about my decision. You know, we took a few months for me to train a replacement, go through the process of, you know, stepping away from all this stuff. I had my last day on site at the hospital, came home at the end of that day. 2 weeks later, it's the morning, my wife's getting ready for work. I'm standing in the doorway of the closet while she's kind of finishing up. We're not even talking. Like, I'm just leaning in the closet doorway looking at her. She stops what she's doing. She looks at me and she says these words, "Holy shit, I have my husband back."
Yay.
That was it. Yay. That was all I needed. I made the right decision, right? Mm-hmm. And then everything thereafter was like, okay, this is going to be all right. Mm-hmm.
Well, I love what you said about, you know, talking to people, and that you had kind of this posse around you. And one of the discussion points that we have a lot on this show is about your network.
Yeah.
And about gathering people around you that will support you, but they'll also tell you honestly.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you're screwing up, you know?
Yeah.
And for me, I have, you know, several people that I've worked with over the years, and one of our fellow friends is just Dad Chuck, Dr. Chuck Kaiser, has been a mentor to me from probably close to day one. But and my husband is absolutely involved in this, because he'll say, okay, it's enough. You've done enough. Turn the computer off.
Yeah,
we're going on a boat ride. Get out. Yeah. You have been in this house for like 10 straight hours. Get out of the house. So sometimes he's just he's like my traffic cop, you know.
Yeah.
We're done for the day, and you're going to take off. So I think having this network of people around you is extremely important. But talk a little bit about how you develop that network, because I think a lot of people they get very isolated or insulated, maybe in their little realm, and they don't ever go outside of that or don't think about coming up and asking somebody who maybe has a lot of experience, or even coming up to either of us at a conference and taking that. You know, I guess it's a fairly brave move to come up and speak to the speaker. I don't think so. I'm sure you don't. It tickles me. I love it when people come up and talk to me.
Me too.
But some people are just really intimidated by that. So tell me how you developed this really cool network of folks, because we have a lot of cool network of folks that are concentric circles for each other, that helps you during that time.
Yeah, you know, I think that's just something that I've always done, is develop a network of people in my life. I really seek out opportunities to meet interesting people, and you know, gain different perspectives. And I think I have a natural affinity to people who share similar values. It doesn't mean that they think the same way. It doesn't mean that they believe the same things. In fact, many of them think very differently and believe very different things than I do. But so long as the core values kind of align with me, then I really love to find ways to weasel my way into their life. I've just always kind of collected people like that. During those difficult times, I definitely started to call on a few of them with regularity. And I had to make that intentional effort. You're absolutely right. It can be very common for us when we get into this kind of survival mode to become insular, to just want to do. And sometimes the better approach is to stop the doing and connect. And in the connecting, you're actually accomplishing so much more than you are in just do mode. But that's, you know, I understand that can be difficult. You know, when you feel the pressure of all of these obligations, you want to meet them. So I think I've just sort of developed the habit, and very acutely over the last few years, developed this habit of maintaining special important connections. One of the big things that I did at that time in particular too was I reached out to the people who care about me, who I trust, and asked them who can help me now. And that led me to starting to work with this coach who was absolutely life-changing for me. And having somebody like that, somebody who can be both objective and caring, is really, really valuable. You know, there's a organizational psychologist by the name of Tasha Yurick, and she did a pretty extensive research project over about 4 years on this idea of self-awareness and leadership, and how those two things really go well together to create high-performing leaders. And so in doing this, she discovered just a lot about this idea of self-awareness. And one of the, she started to call people who are self-aware unicorns, as she, you know, started her research and started to really look for, using really strong validated tools for measuring self-awareness, look for truly self-aware people so that she could study them. It became increasingly difficult for her to actually find them. Based on her research, she determined that somewhere around 10 to 15% of us are like truly self-aware, that to meet her criteria, which means that at any given point in time, as she would say it, 80 to 90% of us are walking around the world lying to ourselves about lying to ourselves. So one of the big findings from these unicorns, these self-aware unicorns, is that same kind of thing. Like, people are not resilient alone. You never find somebody who's like a truly resilient human being who's done it their whole life by themselves. They are resilient because they have support. And it's the same thing with self-aware people. Self-aware people consistently have what Tasha Yurick calls loving critics. People who care about them, who genuinely have their best interest in mind, who want them to be the best version of themselves and succeed, and can be candid and honest with them. And so I sought somebody like that out, and that's what I found in this coach. And this, I'm telling you, totally conclusively, I would not have been able to muster the courage to take the steps that I took in that time in my life if I didn't have my coach, Beatrice, helping me do that.
Yeah. Well, you know, not everybody sort of has the luxury of having a coach or afford a coach, for one thing. But I do think that we all have the ability to read. And I've always been a voracious reader my entire life. And so much of this information is available if you are open-minded and are seeking awareness of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, I have a lot of friends who are people of color. I see that you've got the multiracial, I think that, or is it the Black
Media Network?
Yeah. We did our dress code today.
So yeah, black yeah.
But that awareness of bias, I think, is something that we do go through life a lot and not realize that we are shaming people and that we do have biases. And they're not intentional biases. They are biases that we grew up with because we did grow up in, you know, you're a white guy, right? So there's a whole, I mean, you're at the top of the totem pole, man, is when it comes to privilege, you're
right,
up there.
Right.
And, you know, and I grew up as a young woman, a child, truly, in the 60s and 70s, and looking at, we've had a lot of chatter about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and so I'm a product of that generation who, we didn't wear pants to school. We could not have a credit card in our name. Your career opportunities were extremely limited as a woman. And so I've always been kind of a feminist, which gave my parents a few gray hairs, but it still is the way it is because it was not fair. You know, I have a great sense of fairness, I think, and that was just incredibly unfair to me. And I also grew up in a restaurant in the kitchen is surrounded by people of color. So, you know, that was sort of my norm to be very comfortable around people who were not like me or didn't look like me. And those are the product of childhood. So I say, okay, these are blessings for me, but I realize that other people, you know, didn't do that. So in order to overcome our biases, we have to realize they exist.
Yeah.
And we have biases that say, I can't do that, or biases that say, well, I'm only A, which drives me crazy when people say I'm only a, or just a tech, or just a CSR.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
so I can't
yeah.
possibly go and do anything else because this is all I can do. So we are so self-limiting when we are having this conversation in our head.
Yeah.
That it's an inappropriate conversation. So I think that, you know, the advice that you gave to go and seek somebody who will give you honest feedback, who will shine a light on the story that you're telling yourself.
Yes.
And say, really? Is that really the story? You know, think about it now, because you're talking about it emotionally. I want you to think with your smart brain, not that limbic brain response, and tear that down, you know, just break it down. And you have to do it yourself, you know, because they can sit there and shine the light on it and ask you the appropriate questions, but it's a self-revelation.
Yes.
And until you reveal it to yourself, it's not sticky.
Absolutely. Yeah, you made a great point, Debbie. You said that not everybody has the luxury or can afford to get a coach. And yeah, you're 100% right. Not everybody can do that. That was the best way for me at that time. And I had the wherewithal. I had time to do it. And I had the financial ability to do it. But ultimately what it was just, I needed somebody who could be that loving critic. And so when you said, find somebody, anybody, who can be honest and candid with you and do it in a way because it's coming from a place that they care about your success. They really genuinely want you to be the best version of yourself. Because anyone can find a critic. I mean, it's easy to find somebody who could be critical of us. It's the combination of the two. It's the they're being critical and they have our best interest in mind. And we believe that. So I think anybody can do this. Anybody can find this. If you're in a place that you feel stuck, that you're feeling like you're struggling, that you're considering taking a bend or, you know, going around a curve. Find somebody who you know cares about you and ask them, implore them, give them permission to be candid. Yeah, I mean, that's something all of us can do. Debbie, listen, I'm having this really difficult time. I want to share a story with you. I want to tell you what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling. I know you care about me. So I want you to also add some honest feedback to this and I will be open to it. Now here's my story and then see what happens.
And then we can all do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can all benefit from that. So I wanted to ask you, if somebody was going to make like a career decision right now, well, I want to backtrack a little bit because I want to talk about, you talk about resilience is not done in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges that we have right now is our typical, let's say our posse. We can't touch each other. We can't be together.
Sure.
And a lot of the work I've been called and asked to do here recently has to do with conflict resolution because everybody's just on this anxiety trip.
Yeah.
And it seems like the very least little thing is setting them off, and the limbic brain response is just taking them into places that nobody wants to go. They don't even want to go there, but it's just because they're so reactive right this time moment. Tell me what you think as far as, you know, we are constantly, you and I are in many of the same Facebook management groups. I've had managers say, I've fired more clients this week than I have fired in my career.
Yeah.
Tell me what your perspective is about, you know, this resilience, about our lack of having all those people around us, about the trauma to our humanness, that lack of being able to go and be with people is having on our population.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll tell you, it's interesting. One of the presentations that I routinely do, a lot of the work that I do is on training on psychological resiliency. And I have done more resilience webinars in the past 6 months than in the prior 2.5 years. And it's been great. And a lot of the messages that seem to be resonating are things like this. First of all, I really want to encourage everybody. And I got to be honest with you. One of the side benefits that I have of training on this work is that I'm also training myself constantly. Because I am not perfect at it either. I'm definitely not the world's most resilient person. I also am feeling the anxiety and the uncertainty and the struggle that's going on. I also feel detached. I mean, just yesterday I had an epic tantrum over like, you know, just like silly little things that if I shared the story with you, you'd be like, seriously?
He's one of those clients, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that that's actually the first place for all of us to start. And I try and share this message every time I talk about resilience. I know that it's become cliche to talk about 2020 as unprecedented, but there's truth to every cliche. Nobody gave us an instruction manual for living through a global pandemic in one of the most contentious election years during some unbelievable social upheaval. Nobody gave us the instructions for that. There is not a checklist of like, okay, if we do 1, 2, and 3, we'll be golden. Like, we're all trying to get through this craziness without having any experience on how to do it. And so because it's unprecedented times, I really think it's very important that we all suspend our normal expectations of ourselves. It's totally unfair to expect each of us, to expect myself, for you to expect yourself to be the best version of yourself in the middle of a year that's felt like a decade. Like that's not fair. So you've got to suspend your normal expectations of yourself. That's step one. Step two is to adopt a just like me mentality. If you're suspending the normal expectations for yourself, you also need to be able to do it for others. and recognize that they are struggling just like me. They have opinions, perspectives, and beliefs just like me. They are worthy of respect, inclusion, value, and appreciation just like me. And if we can start to have that kind of internal dialogue, gosh, we have made the first step towards building the bridge of resiliency.
It's a great lesson in empathy. Let us stand in the other person's shoes. Over the years, I've coached and done a lot of communication training with veterinary teams, and I was always the one, and of course, you manage, so you know, we always get the, let's call it the shit end of the stick when it dealing with the difficult customer. But for me, it never bothered me. I was always the one who almost kind of enjoyed it, and it, because it was a personal challenge. I looked at it as a personal challenge, how to make this person happy, and how to really bring out in myself all the knowledge that I had about humanness, about, how this person was thinking, how to be that, to move myself from this side of the exam table to the other side of the exam table, and to think what it would feel like if I didn't know the stuff I know about situation.
Yeah.
And people go, how can you do that? I mean, people have done everything from, one girl says, this customer called me fat. I went, that's hard. I get it. And they say stuff that's there, but understand that it's very similar to that animal that comes into our hospital that we, maybe it got hit by a car, and we know that we need to treat it, and we're trying to help it, but it doesn't know that. It just knows that it hurts, that it's afraid, and that you are possibly going to exacerbate that situation. And so if you think about the human reactivity in the same way that we think about animal reactivity, and look at mitigating it with kindness and empathy and listening rather than moving forward and trying to force action, then we will all be much better off.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Yeah. So it is, we can really, one of the things I learned when I was taking my fear-free certification as I was cranking through this course, and I got through parts 1 through 7 like a breeze. And I went, I teach this about humans all the time. This is human. When I got to Section 8, it was about drugs. I went, I'm in trouble. I'm not a tech. I've never given a tech except my dog. I am in trouble here. So I struggled with 8. I was an A-plus student until I got to Section 8. But really understanding animal behavior helps us so much with human behavior, because it's, the brain's the same, the reactions are the same, the hormones are the same, and we just really need to understand and diagnose the emotion here. And I've taught a lot of doctors that, because if they are diagnosticians, they understand how to sort that out.
And
if there's gut reaction, let me say, what emotion is happening here? What is the reality? Let me see what made this action happen. Let me see how I exacerbated that, inadvertently, but I did. And what is this really anger? Because chances are it's not. It could be fear. It could be disrespect. It could be, a lot of different emotions. But we're not very good as humans on understanding true emotional, the difference of emotion. Because are they disappointed? That's another thing that we continuously do, maybe disappoint people. Are they surprised and blindsided? So if we get better at understanding that emotional circle, and I know you know it well, what emotions are these? Because we just go, they're mad. No, they're not. No, they're not. And no, we're not either. We feel attacked, but maybe we feel embarrassed. And embarrassment and shame is a huge emotional trigger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, you make some great points, and I love that you keep using the word understand. I think one of the things that's important for folks to understand is that when we talk about things like empathy does not equate to permission. And that's a really important, thing to get. So you mentioned this gal who had this, upset client call her fat. Like, trying to get to a place of understanding there does not mean that you give that person permission to treat you that way. You know, so I think that, you know, when these kinds of things happen, our tendency, we feel attacked. We might feel embarrassed, which you're right, could definitely contribute to an experience of shame. And that's going to put us immediately on the defensive. We can react from, you know, what our amygdala is telling us, which is either going to be to get the heck out of there or fight back. Screw you, you a-hole. You're not exactly the skinniest person on the planet, right? And listen, right. That, you know, in the moment, that can definitely feel good. But if the goal is to come to some sort of productive resolution, if the goal is to create a scenario in which things get tamped down and we take care of this pet, right? Then having a reaction for, you know, driven by your amygdala is not going to be productive. So you know, I think we need to recognize that, okay, I am feeling attacked. I'm a little bit ashamed of what they said. I'm angry. And I you know, the blood's starting to boil. And this person is clearly upset about the situation. I don't know what has contributed to that. That doesn't give them permission to treat me this way. And then you can choose to respond. Hey, you know what? I can see that you are very upset right now. And I want to do everything I can to help, you know, remediate this situation. And it is not okay for you to call me names. We can empathize and not give permission.
Right.
You know, there's all these kind of cliche statements. So there was one we were talking earlier and I thought about it and I don't remember exactly what you were saying. You were talking about, you know, kind of the way that we lead and the results that we get. And it just made me think of this statement that's been rolling around in my head constantly lately. Every system is perfectly designed to get the results it gets. Right?
Yes.
Every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it gets. We have a choice. We have an influence. We have some control over the systems that we lead.
Right.
The one that keeps coming to mind for me here with this this permission thing is, oh gosh, now I lost it.
So it's not just me. That's
See, not just you.
Here's our COVID challenge, is our brains just go out here somewhere. And
yep.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Where
what was
I going
about
with that?
2 seconds ago?
Yeah. I had it. It'll come back. It will come back. It's just a little fuzzy.
It's this one. Now I remembered. We are treated in exactly the way we give permission to be treated. And so we want to think of that as sort of like, only in the preemptive sense. Well, I didn't tell that person it was okay to call me fat. No, you're right, you didn't. But how did you respond when they did? And if we respond in a reactionary, defensive, you know, meeting the anger with anger kind of thing way, then I'm sorry, we have given them permission to do that. If we can find a way to respond in a, I see you, I hear you, and what you just said to me is not okay, we have withdrawn permission. And if that person persists, okay, now we get to draw a boundary and say, I can't help you here.
Right.
This is done.
Yeah.
But I think we don't want to go through that middle step. We want to, we want to be timid. We want to be non-confrontational. We want to be non-reactionary because it's way too uncomfortable. Totally get that. It's uncomfortable for me too. I hate it. I really hate it. I would love to not have any confrontation anytime for the rest of my life. And I recognize that it's an inevitable and necessary part of the world. And so I'm going to lean into that discomfort and try my best every time. We want to just ignore that step and go from this person's a jerk, you're fired.
Yeah, right.
And that's fine. You can do that, but all you're doing is giving the next person permission to treat you that way. And then you're going to have to fire them. And I mean, are you going to follow that to its end point? You're just going to fire everybody that's mean?
Yeah, it's bad for business. It's really bad for business.
Right.
And your personal life too. You know, this can affect friendship. And my husband is funny because I guess I'm very pragmatic about people, and he gets disappointed because friends don't do certain things. And I said, well, you know, I don't get disappointed because I didn't expect any more than that out of them. And when they go above that, then I'm pleased. And so that's sort of the way I look at the way things will work. But I love what you said about the goal. What is the goal of this conversation? Because if this is a person who has chronically abuse everybody in your hospital, then that goal is hit the road, Jack. But if this is a really good client that has had a bad experience, and even if it's in an inadvertent, you know, that something that you caused, you didn't mean to do it, then the goal is to salvage the relationship. Mm-hmm. So I love Crucial Conversations. Anybody who's ever read anything I wrote knows that this is like the Bible of communication to me. And they do say, what is the goal of the conversation? What do you want the outcome to be? And if you decide that outcome, then how would you act?
Right.
Think about how you would act. And yes, I want the outcome to be that I salvage the client, that I help the pet, and that their behavior no longer continues to be derogatory. So right. That's the goal of that whole conversation mm-hmm. there. Uh-huh. And I love, there's another favorite book that I have called Talking to Crazy. And sometimes when people are in an amygdala hijack, which is what we're talking about here, there's no point of saying anything because they can't hear you anyway.
Right.
So letting them run for a while and giving them verbal, I'm listening cues, like, I understand, tell me more, I hear you. I used to tell people all the time, the most helpful tool I ever carried into any client confrontation was a pen and a pad.
Yeah.
Because what it did was validate that I was